This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the spring of 1929, more than 1,000 workers at the Luray Mill in Gastonia, North Carolina, walked off their jobs and went on strike. At the time, that mill was one of the largest producers of textiles in the South, but harsh labor conditions and unfair pay sparked unrest among the workers. Protests went on for months and even led to violent clashes with the police. The owners eventually broke the strike with the support of the police. The events at the mill brought a textile worker named Ella Mae Wiggins into the spotlight. She championed the labor movement and served as a union organizer. She also became an influential ballad singer. Here's Pete Seeger singing her song, Mill Mother's Lament.
We leave our homes in the morning. We kiss our children goodbye. While we slave for the bosses, our children scream and cry. And when we draw our money, our grocery bills to pay, not a cent to spend for clothing, not a cent to lay away.
Writer Wiley Cash grew up in Gastonia, but he didn't know about the Luray Mill strike until he was older. Now the strike and Ella Mae Wiggins are the subject of his new novel. It's called The Last Ballad. Wiley Cash is a writer in residence at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. He's going to be reading across the state of North Carolina in coming weeks. But first, he joins me on the program from partner station WHQR in Wilmington. Welcome back, Wiley.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank. I'm proud to be joining you from HQR, where I am a board member.
You are a board member of a fantastic public radio station, and we're happy to have you on this here on this entire network of ours, talking about what is an important moment in North Carolina history, that Luray Mill strike. Tell us more about that 1929 strike.
Well, the strike and my novel that's about the strike, it really traces the tragic convergence of race and class and gender and politics in the summer of 1929 that just amassed in this violent storm in Gastonia, North Carolina, where I was raised.
Yeah, tell us more about the strike, because again, it's a fascinating strike, as you say. In terms of labor relations down here in the South, not very good. There weren't many unions. There was certainly a lot of manufacturing in the state of North Carolina. Conditions not that good, and this is one of the cases in which the Communist Party was very active, and that's an important part of this story because the Communist Party, unlike the AFL, believed that that races should be mixed in labor organizing. They wanted to see black and white together against capital, which was the oppressive force.
Absolutely. So the Luray Mill was built in 1900 with local investors, and then later, several years later, it was purchased by a Rhode Island company called Manville Jinks. And Manville Jinks instituted a lot of northern labor practices that southern mill workers weren't familiar or comfortable with. So, for example, at Luray, they put a chain-link fence around the mill. You could no longer leave work during your breaks to go home and check on your children, even at night. They instituted the stretch-out, which meant that fewer workers were responsible for greater output through mechanizations and the work areas. And so it was rife. It was a hotbed of toil and complaint and underpaid people, because this is the years after World War I when the demand for cotton cloth has slowed down and unemployment is rising and wages are falling. So people are working harder. There are fewer people working harder and making less money than ever before. And the Communist Party, based in New York City, had already led successful strikes in Passaic, New Jersey, New Bedford, Connecticut, and they wanted to organize a mill in the South. And someone told them, if you can organize the Luray Mill, which is one of the biggest mills in the South, you can organize the entire South. And so on New Year's Day in 1929, a man named Fred Beale from Massachusetts rode down to North Carolina on a motorcycle and began snooping around the mill. And on April 1st, the shift walked out, and the Luray Mill strike began.
Tell us more about Ella Mae.
So Ella Mae Wiggins was born in 1900 in East Tennessee. Her family left the farms because they couldn't make any money, and they moved to the lumber camps. This is at a time when the economics of that area are shifting from trade in goods and crops to trade in cash money. And the lumber camps was the only place you could get cash money. Well, her family suffered through life in the lumber mills and the lumber yards. If you've read Ron Rash's Serena, you get a little snapshot of how tough that life was. And so when Ella was in her teens, she met a man named John. They left the mountains and went down to the upstate of South Carolina to a small town called Cowpen, South Carolina. And they began their life in the mills. By 1929, Ella was 28 years old. John had run off and left her. She'd given birth to 9 children. 4 of them had died from whooping cough and pellagra. She worked 72 hours a week in one of the few integrated mills in Gaston County, and she earned $9. And so when she learned about this union strike just a few miles away in Gastonia, she learned about the union's demands of a 40-hour work week, a $20 minimum wage, equal pay for equal work. And she thought, if I join this and these demands come true, my children will live. I will live. It wasn't a matter of not working hard enough. It was a matter of I'm working as hard as I can, and I still might die.
She became interested in joining the union and ultimately became one of the leaders in the union and also a balladeer. So tell us about her rise through the ranks very quickly to become one of the leaders of this movement.
Well, Ella May really exemplified this fierce mountaineer spirit that many of the people coming from Appalachia had. A lot of the people living and working in Gaston County were from the mountains of North Carolina and eastern Tennessee, and they were lured down to the mills in the Piedmont by promises of wealth. And, you know, the mill owners sent what they called barkers up into the hills. They said, if you come down to the mills, we'll feed you, we'll clothe you, we'll send you to school, we'll give you a church, we'll give you a store, we'll give you a house to live in. And then they got down there and they found themselves shackled to this oppressive system of poverty, and they couldn't leave. And so Ella looked at her surroundings and thought, I got to speak for myself. Nobody else is going to do it. And so once she joined the strike, she quickly used her native intelligence, her independent spirit, and also her music to make a name for herself. And she wrote protest songs based on these old ballads that she had learned in the lumber camps doing laundry with her mother. And she changed the words. And Woody Guthrie called her the best American songwriter of all time because she created these intense, hot protest songs off the labor ballad she'd grown up hearing. And she became the face of the strike, which also made her dangerous.
Yeah, and tell us more about this strike. It was dangerous all the way around. There was a lot of violence. There was a sheriff who was killed. The people who were responsible for his death were prosecuted and convicted of murder. Ella May was killed, and there were a lot of strikers who were also killed. There were no prosecutions, and if there were prosecutions, there were no convictions. Tell us what happened during the strike.
So the strike began formally on April 1st. Almost immediately, the strikers' headquarters was destroyed, and their stores were destroyed, which is where they stored food that had come down from New York. Forces up north had sent down food and supplies. And these things were completely destroyed. Then the governor called in the National Guard, and the local police arrested strikers and charged them with destroying their own headquarters and destroying their own food supplies.
Yeah.
And so from the outset, it was greatly stacked against the strikers. And so they moved across the street to a field near the Loray Mill, and they built a new headquarters. And the summer of 1929 was spent with the union struggling to get a foothold to interrupt production at the Loray Mill, which they were never able to shut the mill down. They were able to frustrate the mill, but they were never able to completely shut it down because the people were so poor, they'd strike for a little bit and they'd live off the union stores. And then when the food ran out, they'd go back into the mills to get paid. And so these are people who were literally, you know, it was a communist-led strike, but many of these strikers had no idea what communism meant. They just knew what survival meant. And they had allegiance to whoever could keep them alive in that moment. But Ella May was a believer. She believed in the union, and she believed that the union had to stick together and the union had to increase its ranks. And one of the ways she wanted to do that was by integrating the union. She lived in an area in Bessemer City, North Carolina, called Stumptown, which was majority African-American. And the mill she worked in, American Mill No. 2, was also an integrated mill. So her neighbors and her friends were African-American. And so she was telling the strike leaders, the union leaders, look, we have to integrate this union. We can close mills down if we integrate this union. But the forces on the ground knew these mountaineers, these farmers from the upstate and the Piedmont, they're not going to walk the picket line alongside black people. It's too dangerous. It's too dangerous to integrate right now. But the office in New York was forcing integration. And so even within the union, you have just an intense flashpoint around race.
So this is the story, and by itself a dramatic enough story. Wiley Cash, I'm talking with right now, whose latest novel is The Last Ballad, and it is a fictionalized version of that Luray strike and mill strike in 1929. So tell us about your novel.
So my novel is about a young woman named Ella Mae Wiggins in the summer of 1929 who is quickly caught up in a violent textile mill strike in Gastonia, North Carolina. So I took the elements of Ella Mae's life that I knew to be true. And the only things we really know of Ella's life are the really triumphant moments that she went to Washington, D.C., and she confronted North Carolina senators about labor conditions in the South. She integrated the labor union against the will of local officials. She wrote and performed these protest songs that Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger later performed. And we know her lows. She lost children. She was pregnant at the time of her murder. Her husband ran off and left her. She was almost dying of starvation. But what we don't know is the day-to-day rhythm of her life. What did it feel like to go into that textile mill in Bessemer City, North Carolina, and stand up on a night shift for 12 hours and work a spinning machine? What did it feel like to go home and find your hungry children sleeping on pallets on the floor, unable to find food in the house unless you brought it home? What did those things feel like? And so the novel that I wrote is about, you know, while I'm adhering to the facts of the events of 1929 of that summer, what I'm really interested in is giving readers the experience of what that felt like. What did it feel like to be a mill owner, knowing this union may touch your workforce in 1929? What did it feel like to be an African-American organizer from New York City who sent down to Gastonia to recruit African-American mill workers against the will of the local party? What did that feel like? What were the inherent threats in that?
I wonder if you'd read for us from your new novel.
Absolutely. So this is from the opening page. This is the first time you meet Ella Mae. Ella Mae knew she wasn't pretty, had always known it. She didn't have to come all the way down the mountain from Tennessee to Bessemer City, North Carolina, to find that out. But here she was now, and here she'd been just long enough for another place in her memory to feel like home, but not quite long enough for Bessemer City to feel like home either. She sat on the narrow bench in the office of American Mill No. 2, the wall behind her vibrating with the whir of the carding machines, the rollers and spinners that rage on the other side, with lint hung up in her throat and lungs like tar, reminding herself that she'd already given up any hope of ever feeling rooted again, of ever finding a place that belonged to her and she to it. Instead of thinking thoughts like those, Ella turned and looked at Goldberg's brother's young secretary, where she sat behind the tiny desk just a few feet away. The soft late-day light that had already turned toward dusk now picked its way through the windows behind the girl. The light lay upon the girl's dark, shiny hair and caused it to glow, like some angel had just lifted a hand away from the crown of her head. The girl was pale and soft, her cheeks brushed with rouge and her lips glossed a healthy pink. She wore a fine powder-blue dress with a spray of artificial white spring flowers pinned to the lapel. She read a new copy of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and she laughed to herself and wet her finger on her tongue and turned page after page while Ella watched. How old could that girl be, Ella wondered. 20? 25? Ella was only 28 herself, but she felt at least 2-3 times that age.
That is Wiley Cash reading from his new novel, The Last Ballad. Wiley's going to be reading across the state of North Carolina in coming weeks. We've got the details at our website, stateofthings.org. As we said, you said earlier, she was murdered. Tell us about her death.
So as you mentioned, on the evening of June 6, 1929, there was a raid on the strikers' headquarters. And there is some inconsistency as to what caused that raid. There are reports that the strikers called and reported violence was underway, you know, by their own people. There were reports that some drunk police officers showed up and demanded entrance into the strikers' headquarters. All we know for certain is that evening shots were fired. Nobody knows who fired them first. But the police chief, Orville Adderholt, who by all accounts was fair and judicious and consistent with both the strikers and the mill owners, he was shot and killed. No one knows exactly who shot him. But that night and by the end of the week, 30-something strikers and strike leaders were rounded up and charged with Adderholt's murder. Eventually, a lot of them were freed, and 9 men would stand trial that fall. The first trial ended up in a mistrial because one of the jurors went insane when a wax effigy of the police chief was rolled into the courtroom. And then they rescheduled the trial for later that fall. And on Saturday, September 14th, a huge rally was to be held in Gastonia in support of these jailed strikers, the strike leaders Fred Beale among them. And LMA got together a group of Bessemer City Strikers, integrated Bessemer City Strikers. And she was heading for the Gastonia rally when they were met at a bridge by a blockade, by a roadblock of people hired by the Lorry Mill, the Committee of 100. It was a secret committee that was terrorizing the strikers over that summer. And they were told to turn around and go back to Bessemer City because violence was going to happen if they came to Gastonia. And so Ella's convoy, none of whom were armed, they turned around. And then a little bit farther up the road, one of the cars from that roadblock ran into Ella's car from behind and turned her truck over. And people fled into a nearby field, and Ella was shot in the chest, and she died. Apparently her last words were, "My lordy, they have shot me." And she died at the scene. She had five children who were still alive, and they were whisked away to an orphanage in Statesville. And the story of Ella May's struggle and the tragedy of her death were erased from American history, North Carolina.
No one
history.
Was convicted in her murder. In the second trial of the police chief's murder, six people were convicted of murder. So just to sort of put a cap on that, because I want to get to the next point with you. I think that's how, am I correct in that, that there were no convictions in her death? There was a conviction in the police chief's
death. Believe there were six men arrested for her murder. Lorry bailed them out immediately.
Yeah.
And then Lorry paid for their legal defenses, and all of them were found innocent.
All of them acquitted. The six found guilty in the murder of the police chief. I understand that you you grew up in Gastonia, but didn't know much about this story.
I'd never heard a word. You know, I'd never heard a word of the Lorry Mill strike or Ella Mae Wiggins or any of that until I went to graduate school in Lafayette, Louisiana. And a professor there I met, he said, "Oh, you're from Gastonia. You must be aware of the Lorry Mill strike." And I was humiliated. I had no idea what he was talking about. And so when I looked into it, I found that I'd always known that the Lorry Mill, I'd always known it as the Firestone plant, because Firestone bought it in the 1930s and changed the name of the streets around it. And the Lorry strike was completely erased from history. You know, my mother grew up in a mill village in Gastonia. My dad grew up in a mill village nearby in Shelby. And my mother's maiden name is Wiggins. My grandfather was 22 years old and worked just a few miles away at a mill in South Carolina on the day a woman who shared his last name was murdered. And the strike and the police chief's death and Ella Mae's death, they made headlines across the world. But the truth was covered up in Gastonia.
My guest is Wilmington-based writer Wiley Cash, currently the writer-in-residence at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. His new novel is called The Last Ballad. It's going to be all across the state of North Carolina in coming weeks. Wiley, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.